Welcome to VOA Asia Weekend. Over the next 60 minutes, you'll hear some of the top stories and features of the past week from our daily VOA Asia program. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Here's my colleague, Ira Melman.
Myanmar's leader and Nobel Peace Laureate Aung San Suu Kyi has defended her government's actions before the International Court of Justice in The Hague against genocide accusations. Speaking at the court Wednesday, she called the case against her country incomplete and misleading. Marta Vanderwolf reports from London.
Aung San Suu Kyi defended Myanmar's leadership against claims that genocide is happening in the country.
Can there be genocidal intent on the part of a state that actively investigates, prosecutes, and punishes soldiers and officers who are accused of wrongdoing?
The hearings of the case against Myanmar at the United Nations highest court started on Tuesday and included detailed accusations of mass killings, torture, and rape against members of the Muslim Rohingya minority. The Gambia brought the case to the court to ask for protection for the Rohingya. More than 700,000 have fled to neighboring Bangladesh since 2017. Aung San Suu Kyi, once seen as one of the world's greatest human rights defenders, argued Wednesday that the internal conflict might at most have led to potential violations of international humanitarian law.
If war crimes have been committed by members of Myanmar's defense services, they will be prosecuted through our military justice system in accordance with Myanmar's constitution. It is a matter for the competent criminal justice authorities to assess whether, for example, there had been inadequate distinction between civilians and RSF fighters, disproportionate use of force, violations of human rights, failure to prevent plundering of property or destruction, or acts of forcible displacement of civilians. Such conduct, if proven, could be relevant under international humanitarian law or human rights conventions.
Alison Smith of the NGO No Peace Without Justice says she is eager to see what the court makes of the defense argument.
The fact that there may have been a conflict does not preclude that there might have been genocide, but also the experiences of the Rohingya that we have been speaking with that were unveiled by the Gambia yesterday through the UN fact-finding mission do not speak to an armed conflict, but instead do speak to that genocide has taken place.
A UN fact-finding mission in 2018 found that Myanmar's army showed genocidal intent in its military operations. Hla Kiau is chairman of the European Rohingya Council and demonstrated in front of the court during Aung San Suu Kyi's statement. He says this case is the beginning towards justice for the Rohingya.
We are expecting justice from international community. International Court of Justice will be taking all of the measures to take the action against genocide against our people. Therefore, in this International Court of Justice, we are hoping for justice for Rohingya people as quick as possible. At the end of the day, truth will come out.
Aung San Suu Kyi heads the Myanmar civilian government. Myanmar's military rulers had her under house arrest for 15 years. In 1991, she won the Nobel Peace Prize. However, after becoming part of the government, she has routinely denied reports of ethnic cleansing and defended the military. A first ruling on the case and whether or not the Rohingya should be protected is expected within weeks. Marta van der Wolf for VOA News, London.
Meanwhile, nearly 100 Rohingya appeared in a Myanmar court Wednesday after being arrested for trying to flee persecution, according to their lawyer. They were arrested November 29th after traveling by boat from Rakhine to a southern beach where buses were waiting to take them to the commercial capital of Yangon. Their crime was to leave their hometownships without permission from authorities. Rohingya in Rakhine State live under tight restrictions with little access to health care, education, or livelihoods in conditions Amnesty International brands as apartheid. If convicted, they likely face 2 years in prison for violating the Immigration Act. In New Zealand, a recovery operation is on hold as tremors increase around the volcano where a group of tourists died in an eruption on Monday.
There's a 50-50 chance the volcano on New Zealand's White Island could erupt again. It's where a group of tourists lost their lives to steam and hot ash earlier this week. Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern said getting back there is of paramount importance to recovery teams.
They've been receiving information and advice from GNS, from technical experts, as to the best, most appropriate time for them to be able to return to White Island to undertake that recovery. But having spoken to many of those involved in that operation, they are very, very eager to get back.
But conditions were still dangerous Wednesday, and authorities say they do not want to put any more lives at risk.
We will make decisions based on all of the facts that we have got, and we will not be moving there until the situation is safe for us to operate in.
Emergency crews described Monday's aftermath as overwhelming. Photos show a helicopter with charred rotator blades broken off. 47 people were on the island at the time of the eruption. Dozens are injured and are being treated for burns in specialist units. 14 are known to have died or are missing, with aerial surveillance showing no signs of life on the island.
And it's a really sad, sad time for all of us.
A local Maori community leader says they've performed a traditional ritual to help people retrieve the dead. And at a nearby port, locals bid a sad farewell to the cruise ship that had brought the tourists to the island. Thousands of people visit every year. What is sold as the world's most accessible active marine volcano.
That was Reuters reporter Carolyn Malone.
With Ira Melman, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Stay with us. There's more VOA Asia Weekend coming up.
For listeners in China, there's a new Chinese language iPhone application from VOA. Simply go to the iTunes App Store and type VOA space Chinese, and then look for VOA News Chinese Edition. With this application, you can get the latest news and radio and TV programs in Chinese. It also lets you transfer photos and video directly to Washington. Go to the iTunes App Store and type VOA space Chinese to get your free Chinese language iPhone app from VOA.
We're back with more VOA Asia Weekend. Here's Ira Melman.
The UN Security Council, at the request of the United States, is talking over missile launches by North Korea and the possibility of an escalatory provocation after Pyongyang conducted what it said was a key test at a satellite launch site. Joining us via Skype from UN headquarters in New York is VOA UN correspondent Margaret Bashir. Margaret, is, I understand that this meeting was at first planned to take place earlier in the week and be focused on human rights. Can you talk about what happened?
Sure, Ira. So it was originally going to be a meeting about human rights. That's sort of become an annual exercise within the Security Council in December. Starting in 2014, the council has discussed the human rights situation in North Korea, which is deplorable. They've discussed it each year, and that was originally something the United States pushed. They didn't do it in 2018, in part because there was the Singapore summit in June of that year between President Trump and Kim Jong-un. So I think there was some reticence on the part of the United States to bring up something that irritates North Korea at a time when they were really trying to make diplomatic inroads with them. But we were anticipating them discussing it this year on Tuesday, which was International Human Rights Day. Council members were saying last week they anticipated it, but the Americans sort of blocked that, and they instead are calling for a meeting about recent developments, as they're putting it, on the peninsula, primarily these 13 different ballistic missile tests they've had over the past 6 months and the one on Saturday that you mentioned.
Well, we know that the Trump administration has been trying every which way they know how, or figure out maybe can work out another meeting with Kim Jong-un, or at least moving somewhat closer to North Korea.
I don't know that another meeting would satisfy the North Koreans right now, because they've become really impatient and frustrated. It seems they've been putting out statement after statement over the last about 2 weeks or so, saying the end of the year was the deadline for improving relations. But when they say improving relations, they mean easing or lifting sanctions on them. And that's their end goal in this. They're struggling under financial sanctions and they want them lifted. So if they're going to meet again and there's no sanctions relief on the table, I don't know that Kim Jong-un would even want to do that.
Well, what's been the reaction so far with other UN members, Security Council members?
So I expect today, frankly, we're going to hear from other Security Council members on both the ballistic missiles, but also on human rights, because just because this isn't an officially a meeting about human rights doesn't mean it won't come up in their statements. So I expect certainly from, for instance, the European members of the Council, of which there are several, that we will hear something about the abysmal situation of human rights in North Korea. And we'll hear concern about the missile test. The Europeans, we haven't had meetings for quite some time, a public meeting anyway, on this issue. And when there have been launches on two or three occasions recently, the Europeans as a group have come before the press and read out a statement condemning the missile launches because they're not in, you know, they violate Security Council resolutions. So they don't like when they see them happen.
What else is the U.S. doing to make its point as to what it wants to talk about and not talk about human rights?
Well, they brought in their main North Korea person today from Washington. Stephen Biegun, who's the special representative for North Korea, has come here from the State Department. He had lunch with the 15 members of the Security Council with the ambassadors. He was briefing them in this private lunch session. And then at the meeting this afternoon, Ambassador Kelly Craft will be presiding because the United States is the president of the Security Council this month. She'll be presiding over the meeting, but with her will also be the deputy special representative, Alex Wong, who's also coming to New York for this session.
She's Margaret Bashir. She is the United Nations correspondent for the Voice of America. Thanks, Margaret. Coming your way, the U.S. has done some damage to the World Trade Organization. You're listening to VOA Asia.
VOA Asia Facebook is the choice of millions to see and read the latest stories about Asia and the United States. Follow us on VOA Asia Facebook. VOA Asia is also on Twitter and YouTube. Subscribe to all of our platforms for free. See, hear, read, and share all the latest from VOA Asia anytime. VOA Asia is your trusted source for news, information, and great features. This is VOA Asia Weekend.
Since its founding in 1995, the World Trade Organization has faced numerous crises and helped resolve trade disputes between countless nations. But now, with a little help from the Trump administration, it may now be facing its biggest problem ever. 164 member countries currently are part of the WTO. They come together to create a means of creating rules for international trade and settling disputes between countries without the use of damaging tariffs. Over the years, the WTO created a consensus-based system of regulations, arbitration, and a de facto court system that gave countries a venue for settling claims against each other. However, as of Wednesday, the WTO will likely cease to function in any real sense. Its policymaking arm has been crippled for years over internal disagreements, and now its enforcement arm, a seven-judge panel known as the appellate body, is about to wither away. The result of the Trump administration's decision to block the appointment of new judges to replace those whose terms are expiring. At a news conference, WTO Director General Ricardo Acevedo emphasized that the decision does not mean the end of rules-based dispute settlement between nations.
And in this context, I think it's important to emphasize that WTO rules will remain in force, and members, for the most part, will continue to apply the WTO rulebook out of economic self-interest, commitment to legal principle, and, of course, the desire to preserve sound relations with their trading partners.
Now, that might be some wishful thinking. While smaller trade disputes have bubbled up just in the past year, the United States, under the administration of Donald Trump, has been assertively implementing tariffs on a number of nations, first among them China. Despite the size of its economy, the second largest in the world, the WTO allows China to operate under relaxed rules reserved for developing countries, something the Trump administration has criticized as deeply unfair. American anger at the WTO did not originate with the election of Trump. Multiple administrations, including the Obama administration, have tangled with the organization, particularly over some rulings from the appellate body that U.S. officials have said exceeded its mandate. However, the Trump administration has been the most aggressive in trying to rein in the WTO. In addition to blocking the appointment of new judges, the U.S. has cut funding for the appellate body, slashing its budget by 93%. WTO Director General Acevedo says he hopes the current situation doesn't lead to more tariffs and trade wars.
The fact that we have unilateral measures being put in place is conducive to an environment of unpredictability. And to the extent that we have unpredictability, we lose investments. And if we lose investments, we compromise economic growth. If we compromise economic growth, we compromise job creation. So this is a lose-lose scenario for everyone. So we are of a view that negotiations, conversations, and mutually agreed solutions are the way forward, not, restrictive measures.
Right now, China is asking the WTO for the right to impose $2.4 billion in annual penalties on the United States in a case over Chinese subsidies. I thank my colleague Doug Bernard for preparing this report. The Trump administration got bashing from its own countrymen during the 25th United Nations Climate Conference in Spain. Former New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg, a Democratic presidential contender, former Secretary of State John Kerry, and actor Harrison Ford all criticized the administration for abandoning the 2016 Paris Agreement on climate. As VOA's Lata Chahok reports, speakers also commended young people around the world for standing up to protect the planet.
A group of protesters gathered outside the conference venue in Madrid on Tuesday to call on Japan to abandon coal-fired power plants.
Japan is holding back progress. They refuse to put forward more ambition, and they continue to fund coal.
Massive protests took place in Japan's capital and other major cities worldwide ahead of the Madrid conference. Most of the participants were young people.
Let's listen to young people around the world who will inherit what we have wrought. Their future has already been diminished by our past.
Speaking at an event in Madrid, actor Harrison Ford praised young people for their courage and criticized the U.S. government for a lack of it.
In 2017, my country's federal government demonstrated a lack of courage, threatening to pull out of the Paris agreements.
U.S. President Donald Trump has repeatedly denied the science of climate change and has been a staunch supporter of the fossil fuel industry. But many local governments, corporations, and private groups remain committed to supporting clean energy sources, among them Bloomberg Philanthropies.
I do want the world to know that Americans are continuing to work on climate change, even with a climate denier in the White House. And one of the things that's fascinating is we have been closing coal-fired power plants at the same rate during the Trump administration that we did during the Obama administration.
But Obama's Secretary of State John Kerry expressed disappointment at a lack of progress on climate change.
We thought we were on our way. And then, tragically, the new leader of my country decided to tell people in the world, perhaps as a demonstration of his education, that China was responsible for this, that it's a hoax.
Kerry said no country has done its part since the 2016 Paris Agreement, and that the world's worst polluters, including China, India, and the United States, actually increased carbon emissions since then. Zlatica Hoke, VOA News, Washington.
Swedish teenage climate activist Greta Thunberg has been named Time magazine's Person of the Year for 2019. She is the youngest person to win the award after quickly evolving into one of the world's most prominent climate change activists. A new rehab technology company is helping patients maximize physical therapy and regain movement after paralysis through gaming. Deanna Mitchell checks it out.
Bernadette Gersh said she'd never been a gamer, but for a year straight, she played every day.
2015, I was diagnosed with a brain tumor called a glioblastoma multiforme grade 4.
Aggressive medication used during a clinical trial paralyzed her left arm and leg. As a nurse, Gersh knew she had to take action quickly in order to get moving again.
Everything was totally limp and flaccid on the left side.
She found NeoFect, a tech company that uses games to retrain the brain through physical therapy. After 6 months of daily play, she regained most of the movement in her arm. NeoFect's CEO, Scott Kim, leaned on his own experience with rehab as a young child, born with spina bifida.
I had a major surgery on my back, and after the surgery, like, I had to go through the rehabilitation process. Getting up, you know, lying down, getting back up, and just repeat this.
Kim said repetition is most important part of physical therapy, but it is also boring, monotonous. To change that, NeoFect developed its flagship product, the Smart Glove. It sits on your hand like a light exoskeleton, filled with sensors to track movement.
It becomes virtual controller. So all the motions that you're making with the glove on are recognized by the software.
Software keeps track of progress and uses artificial intelligence algorithms to encourage patients to try greater challenges as they improve.
Now you can say with the software that, oh, you gained like 3 degrees on pronation and 15 degrees in, you know, supination.
NeoFect's latest product is called the Neo Mono, meaning new hand. Kim says it will actually flex a patient's fingers in cases with no movement at all, further using tech and video games to help patients through tough recoveries. Deanna Mitchell for VOA News, San Francisco, California.
I'm Jim Stevenson. Ira Melman and I have more great stories from the past week to share when VOA Asia Weekend continues in just a moment.
For years, the Voice of America has been a steady source of news you can trust. Now, we've added a fresh sound and packed our newscasts with more information than ever before. But one thing hasn't changed. We're still working to earn your trust. Every hour on the hour, VOA News has the latest world news in brief. 5 minutes that includes all the top stories you'll need to stay informed. Make it a habit. Tune in to the Voice of America at the top of each hour for what remains the most trusted source of news in the world.
With many of the top stories from the past week, we continue with VOA Asia Weekend. The United States on Monday called a UN Security Council meeting this week on the risk of North Korean provocation as Pyongyang demands U.S. concessions by a year-end deadline. The United States, which holds this month's presidency of the Security Council, is scheduling the session instead of a planned meeting on human rights in North Korea, one of the world's most authoritarian states. The Security Council also met last week behind closed doors to discuss 13 missile tests by North Korea. That meeting was organized by European nations, which condemned North Korea's actions. But the request for a new session shows growing alarm by the United States on North Korea, which has demanded that Washington propose a new offer by December 31st to kickstart nuclear negotiations. North Korea has warned of countermeasures if not. On Saturday, North Korea also claimed to have carried out a, quote, very important test that will change its strategic position without providing further details. Meanwhile, experts are no longer ruling out the possibility of U.S. President Donald Trump scaling back the American military presence on the Korean Peninsula. Trump questioned the advantage of keeping U.S. troops in South Korea, as the two allies are deep in their disagreements over the cost-sharing deal for American military presence. The United States asked South Korea to pay approximately $5 billion to cover the cost of continuing to station about 28,500 troops on the Korean Peninsula. Evans Revere served as acting Assistant Secretary of State for East Asian and Pacific Affairs and Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary managing U.S. relations with the Asia-Pacific region. He spoke with VOA Korean correspondent Connie Kim.
I was, quite frankly, very disturbed to hear him make those comments and to make that link. It is well known that he has raised serious questions over the years, including during his presidency, about the deployment of U.S. forces to Korea, and even asked, apparently, at one meeting back in 2017, why it was that we even had troops on the Korean Peninsula. But for him to suggest, as he did in those remarks, that the level of our forces in Korea, or even the presence of our forces in Korea, was contingent on the outcome of a monetary negotiation with the Republic of Korea, I found that quite disturbing. I found that unprecedented. I don't think any previous American president has ever implied in any way, shape, or form what the president appears to have said in his remarks. That's not the way we treat allies. That's not the way we treat these negotiations. That's not the way that we treat the presence of our forces on the ground in Korea, who are there to not only defend or help defend the Republic of Korea, but they're also there to help project American power, to defend America's interests in Korea and in Northeast Asia. And for him to suggest that their presence there might end because of the outcome, a possible outcome of this negotiation, was extremely troubling. I hope it's a negotiating tactic. I don't know that it is, since the president is on record as having raised questions about our troop presence, not only in Korea, but in other countries. This seems to be a very deep-seated view of his. It's a long-standing view of his. It's not a view that is shared by the expert community in the United States. And based on my discussions with other American experts, both inside and outside the United States government, it's not a view shared by them either. But once again, he is the president of the United States. And when he says things like this, we need to pay careful attention to them, and we need to call him out when he says things like this. And I think a number of former U.S. government officials have been doing precisely that.
What kind of a message do you think this will send to North Korea, then?
The worst possible message. It suggests that the president of the United States doesn't quite grasp the importance of the U.S. military presence in Korea, both in terms of the role that it plays in these troops play in defending our South Korean ally, but also in projecting power and defending our interests on and around the Korean Peninsula. And that lack of understanding, I think, works to the advantage of North Korea, which has as its goal the idea of driving a wedge in the US-ROK alliance, undermining the rationale for the presence of U.S. forces in Korea, and ultimately removing U.S. troops from the Korean Peninsula. That's a North Korean goal. That is a policy goal of the North Koreans, and I know that because they've told me that. They make no bones, the North Koreans do, about their desire to end the U.S. military presence and end the US-ROK alliance. And so for the president to be making comments like this, I think provides ammunition, if you will, to the North Koreans.
Mm-hmm. What about in terms of China, leverage against China?
I would say the same thing. China shares the North Korean goal of seeking to eliminate the U.S. military presence on the Korean Peninsula. Just earlier this week at Brookings on Monday, I delivered a major new paper that I wrote on China-North Korea relations. And one of the things that I said in that paper and said in my presentation, that China and North Korea have a shared interest in reducing and or eliminating the U.S. military presence on the Korean Peninsula. And so for the president to be making these comments, I think is something that will probably be very well received in Beijing as well as Pyongyang.
Evans Revere, former Acting Assistant Secretary of State for East Asian and Pacific Affairs and Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary Managing U.S. Relations with the Asia-Pacific, speaking with VOA Korean correspondent Connie Kim. A Chinese military supply ship has made its first transfer from a civilian vessel. Routine though that may sound, China's official Xinhua news agency reported the mid-November operation near the southeast coast kicks off a bigger program to resupply naval ships without requiring a return to shore. Improved at-sea resupply capacity, in turn, will enable the People's Liberation Army Navy to better control tracts of disputed waterways in East Asia and operate in other parts of the world, especially the Indian Ocean, according to analysts. Leaders from Vietnam to the United States are watching warily as China, which lacks far-flung maritime bases, bolsters its resupply fleet after adding a list of other hardware to the Navy. A breakthrough in resupplies would complement other Chinese naval upgrades, including the use of drones, the construction of an aircraft carrier, and overall increase in the number of ships. Carl Thayer, Southeast Asia Specialized Emeritus Professor with the University of New South Wales in Australia, says islets under Chinese control in the seas Spratly Islands could become forward-deployed outposts if better resupplied.
One massive resupply ship that can bring supplies into artificial islands, and that just builds up the stocks. China now can stay forward deployed and operate from these bases as long as those bases are resupplied.
Vietnam and the Philippines vigorously contest much of the Spratly chain. China vies for control over the sea with Brunei, Malaysia, the Philippines, Taiwan, and Vietnam. Those governments prize the waters for fisheries, commercial shipping lanes, and vast fossil fuel reserves. China already has the world's third strongest armed forces overall and more firepower in the sea than the other claimants. Our thanks to Ralph Jennings in Taipei for contributing this story. You're listening to VOA Asia Weekend. There's much more right after this.
After you listen to VOA Asia, you can see VOA Asia. VOA Asia is on YouTube. See and share the fun with Food Bites, our weekly culinary dive into foods from the homeland. Recipes that came with chefs who immigrated to the United States. Students enrolling in U.S. schools can get their first lessons about life on campus. Subscribe for free. See us often at VOA Asia YouTube.
We continue now with VOA Asia Weekend. India's ruling party, the BJP, introduced a controversial bill in Parliament Monday seeking to grant citizenship to non-Muslim illegal immigrants from neighboring countries, introducing religion as a criterion for nationality for the first time. Opponents have slammed the proposed legislation as anti-Muslim and divisive and called it a ploy by Prime Minister Narendra Modi's Hindu Nationalist Party to weaken the secular foundations of India's democracy. The bill would make six religious groups who came to India from Pakistan, Bangladesh, and Afghanistan before December 31, 2014, eligible for Indian citizenship. The government says it is intended to give sanctuary to minorities who fled religious persecution in these countries. Critics, however, have questioned why the proposed legislation has excluded Muslim minorities, such as the Rohingyas in Myanmar, if it was meant to protect those facing religious persecution. The BJP has defended the proposed law, saying it is confined to three Islamic countries where minorities such as Hindus and Sikhs often face harassment. Many in the opposition slammed the bills as regressive. Muslims are India's largest minority and fear deepening religious polarization during Modi's rule. The BJP, which returned to power with a resounding majority in lower house 6 months ago, is confident of passing the bill, which was shelved during its previous term because it lacked a majority in the upper house of parliament. It still lacks the vote numbers in the upper house. Any bill needs to be ratified by both houses of parliament to become law. We thank Anjana Pasricha in New Delhi for providing details. As we continue with VOA Asia, Democratic and Republican leaders of the U.S. House Judiciary Committee laid out sharply divergent views on Monday for and against the impeachment of President Donald Trump. The Judiciary panel is drafting articles of impeachment against Trump amid vocal debate. There is some division among Democrats about whether to limit impeachment articles to allegations Trump abused his power by asking a foreign government for help in a U.S. election, and obstruction for a White House refusal to turn over documents and allow key Trump aides to testify in the investigation, or to expand to include allegations Trump sought to obstruct special counsel Robert Mueller's investigation of Russian interference in the 2016 election. Trump could become the fourth president in U.S. history to face formal impeachment charges in the House. As the impeachment battle intensifies, both sides are keeping a close watch on public opinion polls. VOA national correspondent Jim Malone has more from Washington.
House Speaker Pelosi made the historic announcement at the Capitol.
With allegiance to our founders and a heart full of love for America, today I am asking our chairman to proceed with articles of impeachment.
The House Committee on the Judiciary will come to order.
The move comes after weeks of House hearings on allegations that the president abused his power by pressuring Ukraine to announce an investigation into political rival Joe Biden, the leading Democratic presidential contender.
Our democracy is what is at stake. The president leaves us no choice but to act because he is trying to corrupt once again the election for his own benefit.
Republicans remain loyal defenders of the president, including House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy.
This is the day the nation is weaker, because they surely cannot put their animosity or their fear of losing an election in the future in front of all the other things that the American people want.
Trump has returned from the NATO summit, where he kept up his attacks on the impeachment effort.
The impeachment hoax is going nowhere. The Republican Party has never been so unified as it is right now. I have never seen anything like it.
Public support for Trump's impeachment and removal from office has grown since the probe began in September and remains at about 50%. Overall, the country remains split on whether to remove the president from office, with passionate views on both sides.
He's guilty. He should be out. He should have been impeached a long time ago for everything else he did.
I am against the impeachment. I think it's ridiculous. I think they've been going after Trump ever since before he got inaugurated.
Can you remark?
Analysts note that the recent weeks of public hearings have done little to shift public opinion, including Vanderbilt University expert Thomas Schwartz.
What I have observed is that there's no real detectable change in the public opinion polls as to the president's favorability or his job approval. And so it doesn't seem to have, as the cliche goes, moved the needle at all on his overall standing.
I shall resign the presidency effective at noon tomorrow.
In 1974, then-President Richard Nixon resigned from office after many Republicans deserted him over the Watergate scandal. But given the deep-seated political polarization in the U.S. today, building a bipartisan consensus is difficult, says Susan Lowe Block.
Well, it's definitely a very polarized age. And the other thing that's different from Nixon is we have polarized networks. So we have not everyone believes the same facts. The public is divided as to facts, and that's a very serious problem.
Democrats are moving to hold an impeachment vote in the House by the end of the year. That would lead to a trial in the Republican-held Senate, where a two-thirds majority vote is required for removal from office, a prospect analysts find unlikely at the moment. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
There's more VOA Asia Weekend coming up.
News is mobile, and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
It's the end of another week. Sit back and relax as we continue with more VOA Asia Weekend. Scientists launched genetically modified mice into space on December 5th. It was part of a study to find ways to help maintain the health of astronauts in space. They have twice the muscle mass of their ordinary counterparts, and as VOA's Arash Arabasadi reports, the research could provide insight into muscular degeneration in older populations and those with muscle-wasting conditions.
Spacewalking astronauts face rapid aging from the effects of radiation and low gravity outside of Earth's orbit.
In spaceflight, the dominant factor is weightlessness, or zero gravity, if you will. And every system in the body changes.
To better understand and maybe even combat those changes, scientists launched lab-grown supermice destined for the International Space Station, or ISS.
The mighty mice are a strain of mice that we generated through genetic engineering. And these mice are completely normal, except they lack just a single gene, and that's the gene that encodes myostatin.
Professor Si-Jin Lee began modifying the myostatin in mice in the 1990s. Myostatin is a protein in blood and normally limits muscle growth. Without it, these mighty mice have about twice the muscle mass of their non-mighty counterparts. Scientists will study if genetic engineering may fight physical changes from space travel.
We see some changes in bone and muscle because they're unloaded compared to being in normal gravity. So they start to atrophy or lose mass and strength. That's why we exercise very hard. And then we see some more sinister changes that we worry about, such as those with the eye, the optic nerve, and the brain.
Astronauts can somewhat counteract the losses to muscle mass and bone density through weight training, but they face even greater risks in space.
In low Earth orbit, we're underneath the geomagnetic fields, which serve as a shield for us in a way. And we'll get about three times as much ionizing radiation in deep space as we would in low Earth orbit.
The long-term effects of radiation become a greater concern as astronauts look to longer and deeper space travel to Mars and beyond.
Touchdown confirmed.
Professor Lee hopes his mighty mice may not only offer solutions to damage caused by long-term space flight, but also help understand muscle loss in aging populations and those with muscle-wasting conditions. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News, Washington.
The recent film release, A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood, shows how two polar opposites, an empathetic Mr. Rogers, an American TV personality who spoke to children, and a cynical writer, became friends. Conversely, The Joker, a billion-dollar box office hit, offers a dark portrait of Batman's nemesis thriving on rancor, revenge, and social chaos. VOA's Penelope Pullu looks at the two films' contrasting messages.
This piece will be for an issue about heroes. Do you consider yourself a hero?
I don't think of myself as a hero. No, not at all.
A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood is based on a true story of how a cynical journalist hiding childhood trauma meets beloved television personality Mr. Rogers for an Esquire magazine profile about heroes.
Everyone, this is Lloyd Vogel. He is a wonderful writer.
Matthew Rhys plays award-winning journalist Lloyd Vogel, who receives an obligatory assignment to cover Fred Rogers. Following the initial meeting between the two men, they go on to develop a deep friendship. Through kindness and insight, Mr. Rogers, played by Tom Hanks, helps Vogel heal from his trauma.
Sometimes we have to ask for help, and that's okay.
I started looking at many, 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 many hours of the half hour of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. I read the scripts, his handwritten scripts of the shows. But rather than try to go with a microscopic mole for mole imitation of Fred Rogers, it was a cadence, a quietness, a slowness.
We'll just take a minute and think about all the people who loved us into being.
Critics say Tom Hanks's presence and his uncanny interpretation of Mr. Rogers is as healing as the television personality himself. Many forecast an Oscar nomination for the two-time Academy Award-winning actor.
My neighbor.
Critics and audiences are divided over Joker. Some recognize Joaquin Phoenix's artful portrayal of a marginalized man's descent into insanity, while others fear that many people will empathize with the lone shooter, leading to copycat acts of social violence. As we head into the Oscars season, it remains to be seen which of the two forces, that of the Joker or that of Mr. Rogers, will prevail. Penelope Pullu, VOA News, Washington.
Please won't you be my neighbor?
That
was wonderful.
With Ira Melman, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington.
Do you lead a busy life? Not always able to catch your favorite VOA radio or TV program? If you are keen to stay in touch with world news and events, give VOA Podcasts a try.
VOAnews.com.
Visit our website at VOAnews.com to learn how you can become a subscriber to VOA Podcasts and keep your life up to date.
VOA News, your trusted source for news and information.
We continue with more VOA Asia Weekend. An attorney assisting Gambia with its lawsuit against Myanmar alleging state-sponsored genocide at the UN's top court says he is confident the West African nation will win the case based on copious, strong evidence of army atrocities against Muslim Rohingyas. In the lawsuit, Muslim-majority Gambia accuses Myanmar of breaching the 1948 Genocide Convention for the brutality military-led crackdown on the Rohingya in 2017 that left thousands dead and drove more than 740,000 across the border into Bangladesh. The West African country took the legal action on behalf of the 57-member Organization of Islamic Cooperation. The first public hearings at the ICJ will be held this week, beginning Tuesday. Paul Reichler is an attorney at Foley Hoag LLC in Washington, which is representing Gambia. Reichler spoke with Radio Free Asia's Myanmar's correspondents.
The fact that Myanmar denies its responsibility for committing genocide is what makes this a dispute. And shows why it's necessary to go to the International Court of Justice as an impartial third party, the world's highest judicial authority, to determine the truth, to determine, based on the evidence and the law, whether the Gambia is right in alleging that Myanmar is guilty of committing genocide. The evidence is plentiful. There are many, many fact-finding reports by UN missions, by special rapporteurs, by human rights organizations. There is satellite photography. And there are many, many statements by officials and army personnel from Myanmar, which all together show that the intention of the state of Myanmar has been to destroy the Rohingya as a group, in whole or in part. And we're very confident that at the end of the day, that the evidence will be so compelling that the court will agree with the Gambia.
The Myanmar authority also assert that this lawsuit is mean a violation of national integrity and sovereignty. So how valid are these statements?
The states are sovereign, to be sure, and Myanmar is a sovereign state. But when states voluntarily become parties to international treaties and international conventions, they voluntarily accept the obligations, as well as the rights, that pertain to them under those conventions. Myanmar is a party to the Genocide Convention. It has been a party since Burma ratified the convention many, many years ago. And it has remained a party, and therefore it voluntarily accepted the obligations that every party has under that convention not to commit genocide against any group of people based on their ethnicity, religion, race, or other factors.
A portion of Radio Free Asia's interview with Paul Reichler. He's an attorney at Foley Hoag LLC in Washington, which is representing Gambia. Myanmar has largely denied that its military was responsible for the violence in Rakhine State, which included indiscriminate killings, mass rape, torture, and village burnings, and has defended the crackdown as legitimate counterinsurgency against a group of Muslim militants. The government has also dismissed credible evidence in numerous reports and satellite imagery that points to the atrocities and claimed that the Rohingya burned down their own communities and blamed soldiers for the destruction. 140 bushfires continue to burn across eastern Australia. A huge blaze near Sydney is bigger in size than the city itself, and it could take weeks to put out. Although conditions eased Saturday, the dangers persist. Phil Mercer in Sydney has more.
Sydney is again shrouded in a toxic, smoky haze. Health warnings have been issued, and many weekend sporting activities have been cancelled. Several blazes have combined to create a mega fire north of Australia's biggest city. The fire's front is 60 kilometres long, and officials warn it's simply too big to put out. Lauren McGowan works in a bar in the nearby city of Cessnock.
Everyone's a bit on edge. It's getting a little bit too close to home for around here. Like, even like people that we have working here, the fire's practically on their doors.
There are 95 bushfires here in the drought-hit state of New South Wales. Half are burning out of control. More than 2,000 firefighters are on the ground. Their task is unrelenting, but reinforcements have arrived from overseas, including Canada, New Zealand, and the United States. Morgan Kerr, a senior firefighter from Edmonton, has flown in to join his Australian counterparts, who have in previous years battled blazes in Canada.
First time away from Christmas, as it is with all of these guys. Certainly a tough conversation, but we're happy we've been assisted four times out of the last 5 years.
There are hazardous conditions in Queensland to the north. Parts of that state are blanketed in smoke and dozens of blazes still rage. The World Health Quality Index, a non-profit environmental project based in China that measures global pollution, has shown unhealthy levels of air quality in many areas. Authorities say that only heavy rain will put some of the fires out, but ominously, the forecast is for more hot and dry conditions over the Australian summer. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
This is VOA Asia Weekend.
VOA Asia is on Twitter. Follow us at VOA Asia for developing stories in Asia, perhaps close to you. Our Twitter feed also has updates on programs you can hear and see with links to find them easily. With VOA Asia, you can also follow radio program hosts VOA Stevenson and VOA Melman. VOA Asia Twitter. We're always online for you.
We continue with more VOA Asia Weekend. Perhaps you've thought about, or actually do, drive for a rideshare company such as Uber and Lyft. Those companies and others have changed transportation in hundreds of cities around the world, allowing people with vehicles to earn money as drivers while giving commuters an alternative means of travel. But are the rideshare drivers fairly compensated? Do they work for Uber and Lyft as employees, or are they considered as independent contractors? A new proposed law in California aims to settle the matter, but critics say it raises as many questions as it answers. In Los Angeles, Mike O'Sullivan explores what's steering the legislation.
A protest in Los Angeles in November.
I believe that we will win.
I believe that we will win.
Like protesters who rallied in September, these Uber and Lyft drivers want better pay, health care, paid vacation, and other benefits. Right now, drivers only earn a cut of their fares plus tips.
We made $100, $200 a day. But when you deduct all the expenses, how much you pay for gas, if you change your oil, how much you pay for your car wash.
She says there's not much left. And are the drivers business owners or employees? A California law that takes effect in January tries to answer the question, but all sides say the matter has not been settled. One driver who works for Uber and Lyft doesn't want to be an employee of either company.
It's going to limit my income. It's going to limit my freedom on being able to be king of my schedule.
But the relationship, says a labor analyst, is one-sided.
If you are an independent contractor, you come into the room, you bring a contract, and then you negotiate the conditions of the work. With Uber and Lyft drivers, there's a template. You basically have to say yes.
In September, California Governor Gavin Newsom signed a bill to impose strict tests to distinguish contractors from employees in many fields.
Because it can be a construction worker. It can be a nail salon worker, janitors. It can be, other more professional skills. Some of them got carved out.
Some are exempted, including doctors and lawyers. Worried truckers who want to stay independent also want an exemption. And restaurants that rely on internet-based delivery services say it will hurt business.
That's a brick and mortar that's actively engaging to expand their business through technology, and that needs to be supported and protected at all costs.
Uber and Lyft say that forcing drivers into a traditional job structure hurts drivers.
That limits their flexibility. And we know from research that at least 75% of these drivers want to remain flexible.
Uber, Lyft, and the food delivery company DoorDash are spending $30 million each to promote a compromise measure, which they hope to qualify for next year's election ballot. It would offer a guaranteed base wage and other benefits and provide for better screening and safety training for drivers. Critics say there are too many loopholes. In response to driver protests, a New York law that took effect last February guarantees drivers more than $17 an hour plus payments for distance.
We've seen that the driver pay has gone up since that time. The companies are now limiting the number of new drivers into the system, and fares aren't that different from what they were before.
In California and other places, both sides say the issues will be resolved through negotiation, fine-tuning local and state laws, challenges in court, and at the ballot box. Mike O'Sullivan, VOA News, Los Angeles.
A new study is sounding the alarm on the decline in life expectancy in the United States. Although it says that has increased by almost 10 years over the past six decades, close to 79 years, it has dropped for three consecutive years since 2014. VOA correspondent Mariama Diallo spoke with the co-author of the study.
The overall decrease in life expectancy has been driven by an increase in mortality among the working age group of 24 to 65-year-olds, says Stephen Wolf, who co-authored the report.
A big piece of this is an increase in deaths from drug overdoses. That has been one of the biggest drivers of the trend.
According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, on average, 130 Americans died every day from an opioid overdose in 2017. However, this is not the only ill that cut American lives short.
There's been increases in death rates in that same age group for alcoholism, for suicides, for dozens of organ system diseases, and I'm referring to things like diabetes and lung disease and heart disease, that has also increased in this same age group. Altogether, we counted 35 causes of death.
John Hager of the National Institute on Aging says this is unprecedented.
Demographers have their hair on fire. This is a big deal. We haven't seen something like a decline in life expectancy in this country since the early years of the AIDS epidemic and before that in the great years of the international flu epidemic after World War I.
But he also says the decline in life expectancy is the combination of a process that's been decades in the making. The study was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association. Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Washington.
As the Centers for Disease Control says, Americans are dying younger and life expectancy is down. One tactic to reversing the trend might be to call dogs to the rescue. VOA's Carol Pearson reports that research on dogs may help us reverse the aches and pains of aging.
Dogs are so attuned to humans that many people think of them as family. Sandy Schrager fits in that category.
I can't imagine, you know, my life without them. So they're just a central point part of my life.
Come on, girl. Let's go.
According to a pet owner's survey, there are some 90 million pet dogs in the United States. The University of Washington is recruiting 10,000 of them for a study on aging. Professor Daniel Promislow at the University School of Medicine explains.
The goal is to follow dogs for their entire lives, young, old, big, small, males, females, all dogs all around the U.S., to understand how the biology and the environment shape healthy aging in dogs.
The researchers plan to make the study's findings available to all scientists. One day, age-related cancers or even dementia will be a thing of the past. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
This has been VOA Asia Weekend, a compilation of some of the stories presented throughout the past week on our daily VOA Asia program. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Check out VOA Asia online at voanews.com.